protect the supply. My name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm a drug addict, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. So, and I'm an adult child. So there's a lot of reasons that would bring me to any meeting where recovery is going on. I spent today up in San Francisco with a bunch of folks, many of whom had a slight acquaintance with cocaine. And I find lots of feelings are exactly the same, and recovery is very, very much the same. And tonight, what I'd like to do a little bit is talk about recovery. The reason I want to do that is because my drunkalog is a real bore. I tried as best I could, and I never even got a tattoo. Most of my body parts still functioning, too, and that wasn't happening a lot either in the hospital. So I felt like I maybe got in too early, you know, something like that. It was real nuts. I was 29 years old when I got sober. That was in August of 1976. I got sober in Berkeley, and my introduction to any kind of sober living took place there, and I'm real grateful for that. I didn't know anybody who was sober before I got here. I was the first member of my family to enter the program. There have been a couple others who've come in after me, but we didn't have a lot of real healthy role models around. And I remember one of the biggest fears that I had when I came in to the program was, who would I have for friends if I didn't drink and use? And who would be there to talk to? And it was real painful because some people who I thought were good friends, once I got sober, had nothing more to say to me. That was real painful. That really was. And I can remember feeling very, very isolated and alone because I was going to a lot of meetings, but I didn't know how to talk yet. So people would say, how are you? And I'd say, fine. Want to go to coffee? No. You see, and it was hard to connect with the human race for a long time until, because I didn't know what you did at coffee. I wasn't good at small talk, and everyone else seemed so comfortable, and everyone else seemed to get along so well with everyone else, and I was just real tight and nervous after those things. So I went a couple times and it didn't work, and so I just never went back. But I found out that what the fellowship did was the fellowship kept reaching out and saying, would you like to go for coffee? And what I also remember clearly in those early days was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was the only place I felt safe. And there were a lot of places I didn't feel safe, but I would feel safe here. And there were times I would come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous like a refugee coming in out of the storm. Just needing to be able to be with other sober people who don't take offense at the fact that I'm not drinking or using. And bit by bit, life started changing. When I got sober also, we did some things in Berkeley you don't do here. As you know, every little area has its own customs, and that can really drive you crazy if you travel much and are real narrow, because you become convinced that your home group is the only way that does it right, and everywhere else is wrong. In Berkeley, we never clapped. We would read from different parts of the book. We'd read chapter 3, we'd read chapter 5, we'd read chapter 11. Everybody would share. We'd all talk about our therapists, all those things that you have to do in Berkeley. And I would travel out to other kinds of meetings, and my first sponsor and I would sometimes go over to San Francisco, and they did it wrong there. They started their meetings half an hour early, and they were only an hour long, and we didn't know how anybody could stay sober on that kind of a time schedule. So we take their inventories all the way back to Berkeley and stay there. I was sober a couple of years and ended up at an AA meeting in London, England, and they drank tea at that meeting. And I wanted to know how could they stay sober because in real AA meetings we would drink black coffee and smoke Marlboro cigarettes. That's what we do in real AA. I was sober maybe 4 or 5 years, and a friend of mine was being ordained a priest in Chihuahua, Mexico, which is kind of backwater Mexico, and he lived in the backwater of the backwater, and I went down to spend a couple of days with him, and Bill would hang out at the AA clubhouse, and in his area of Mexico, his area of Chihuahua, it was about 100 yards off the paved road. And thousands of people built their own homes out of concrete, were bringing in their own electricity and doing their own sewage, own plumbing. It was very politically correct. And one of the things that was going on there was their little AA clubhouse with a hard earth floor. So I went there, and I was the tallest person in the room. And everyone else was chatting away in Spanish, and there were pictures on the wall of Dr. Bob and Guillermo W., and I was the first Yankee that had been to that clubhouse in a long time, and I was instant celebrity. It was wonderful. And rather than hear each other's stories, they wanted to know, what's AA like in the North? So speaking from the Berkeley experience, I spoke on behalf of all of you. I want you to know that. And went on for about, 10 minutes. I'm being official and saying great things and analysis and being scientific about how it works up here and stuff. And there was this real old guy at the meeting who was about 700 years old. And after I rattled on, and my Spanish isn't that good, so I would do English and Bill would do Spanish for me to translate. This old guy looked at me and kind of focused in, and he said, "Do you people use the same 12 steps?" So I looked up on the wall, and there were los 12 pasos, and I said, I took about a minute or two, and I read them all. Segundo. And I got to the end, and I said, "Yeah, we do have the same 12 steps." And this old man said, "Then you'll probably stay sober." And I think that's very important information. What keeps us sober are not our quaint customs, but the 12 steps and how the program works. And I've been real lucky in the last while. I've spent most of my last 2 years hanging out a lot with drunks and junkies. And I find that to be one of the most comfortable places for me to be. It's embarrassing for my family. They don't know how to explain this. We're from a dysfunctional family. And alcoholism in my family was like having a rhinoceros in the living room. Same. Everybody knew it was there, kind of hard to miss. But you also knew if you said, "Good Lord, there's a rhinoceros in the living room," you're the one that would have to take it out. So none of us volunteered for that job. What we did instead was learn how to decorate the rhino. See? And you can put tablecloths over them and cute little lights around the horn and turn the TV up real loud. And the rhino in our house slept a lot. When the rhino would wake up, what we were supposed to do was throw ourselves up against the wall, preferably in the form of the cross, and wait for the rhino to stop moving. And when the rhino would stop moving, we'd come down from our positions and respond to the chorus, "Act like nothing happened." And we just lived like that for years, so we always acted like nothing happened. And it's a crazy-making way to live, because then you don't know what went on last night. Was that me, or was that them? You know, and it gets very confused for a long time, and you start getting into your own recovery, and people say, "Listen now, if you're going to recover, you have to be truthful, you have to be honest, and you have to tell the truth." And you always want to raise your hand and say, "What does that look like?" You know, what does the truth look like? Because I didn't know. And they started talking about fearless and moral inventories, and I wanted to know what moral was. And I knew lots of theories, But as far as what's the difference between right and wrong, I'm not even so sure what the difference is between pain and pleasure. You know? And how do you get well when you come in completely confused? You say, well, I came in completely confused, so I'd like to talk about that. My first meeting was in Oakland, actually. That's not quite true. My first meeting was in Nespelem, Washington, which is a little village where Chief Joseph is buried, and the two big tribes in that neighborhood are the Colville and the Nez Perce. And the only thing that was, I used to go out there when I was in college in Spokane. I would go out to Nespelem and get loaded. But one night we got there, and it was too early to get loaded. Can you believe that? And so we were looking for some entertainment, and the only thing going on was a little AA meeting inside the Catholic Church. So I went, my first AA meeting. And there were all of these folks, a dozen people, maybe maximum, sitting around drinking black coffee, smoking Marlboro Box, you know, the typical AA meeting, and talking about feelings. And I can remember being very moved by this. And very impressed by this, and I identified with almost every one of the feelings. But I wasn't done yet. So I told them that I thought they were just sensational, and I headed out the door. To come back 5 years later in Oakland, and the meeting I came into was an old-timers meeting. Now, one of my problems is I always thought I was too young to be an alcoholic, and not even 30, and they cut off the best of my drinking years, you know, just as I was catching my stride, you know. I thought it was very unfair, and I went to my first AA meeting very angry, and the guy who chaired the meeting was 1,000 years old, and everybody else was a zillion, and they were just laughing and talking, and they all had short hair, and they were all clean-shaven, and they all had tattoos, and they all wore socks. So we had nothing in common. Just nothing in common. And I sat there, and I was not happy to be there. Okay, I mean, some people are so happy to get here. I was not happy to be there. I was not looking forward to recovery. I didn't know what recovery looked like or smelled like or anything. All I knew was I was in my first AA meeting, and I felt very ashamed and that this was very unfair. And they talked and they talked about stuff. And I finally talked and I said, hi, my name is Tom and I'm an alcoholic, because that's what they all said, and you learn the scam. And they fired back, hi, Tom, which is really very disturbing the first couple of times. That goes on. And then I said, this was a Friday night meeting, and my last drink was on Wednesday, which was the day Gerald Ford was nominated for President of the United States. Remember him. And I said, you know, I haven't had a drink since Tuesday night. And when I said that, these women and men with whom I had absolutely nothing in common burst into applause. And that had never happened to me before. I've had friends for years and stuff, and a lot of them had been very concerned about my drinking and occasionally would talk to me about it. And they'd, when I wasn't drinking, you know, I'd say, Tom, how you doing? And I'd say, gee, I'm not drinking. They'd say, how long's it been? And I'd say, a couple of weeks now. And they'd say, wow. Or they'd say, let's change the subject. Or they'd ask the children to leave the room. It was always embarrassing somehow to be talking about being sober, because earth people don't know what to do when you say, today's my birthday. I haven't had a drink or a joint or a pill in a year. Sometimes they say, oh, I'm so sorry. They just don't know. And the appropriate response really is wild applause and passionate hugging and exchanging phone numbers and stuff. But I was not interested. I mean, I didn't go there to meet people. I didn't go there to get phone numbers. I just went there not to drink. Thank you. So I was going to sit there and wait. But they just applauded, and it then occurred to me, that this was a group of people who knew what it meant to not have a drink since Tuesday night. And I never met anybody like that before. And at that moment, I felt not home, but I felt a little bit of hope, which for me is a cold feeling. Hope is not my favorite feeling. Hope means sit here, don't move, it'll pass in a while, you know? The hope is it'll pass in a while, but it's just an awful kind of sensation. Then this other guy started talking at the meeting, and he was about 6.5 feet tall and weighed 280 pounds and was 10 days out of Santa Rita prison, where he spent time for doing something that seemed like a real good idea after a couple of drinks, you know. So, and he shared with me the first true things I could practically use in AA. I mean, we use jargon in AA, and I always want to apologize for the jargon we use, because we can use all the words and have no idea what it means. I mean, I can. We, nothing. I sure can. And people always say, well, how's your program? What's your program? You working a program? What's your program look like? How much does your program weigh? And I always... what do people talk about by program? I mean, I always thought program was like Channel 5, you see. So what do we mean by program? And a program basically are the kinds of things you do during the day to maintain a healthy spiritual condition. That's the program. And programs to work need to be practical and simple. And if they're practical and simple, they work just dandy. This guy next to me, the ex-con, whose name is Gary, told me the first true things I heard, and I used this for my program for over a year. This is what I did to stay sober. Number one, he said, we here at Alcoholics Anonymous go to lots of meetings, which I did not know. I didn't know what you at Alcoholics Anonymous really did. See, I missed the great alcoholic movies. I've never seen I'll Cry Tomorrow and The Days of Wine and Roses and Lost Weekend and all that. I've never seen those, even as of today, and I think it shows real bad training on my part. But he said, we go to a lot of meetings. Now, I can remember coming into these, in my first months of my sobriety, I had a huge amount of exhaustion. I was very burned out when I got here and very run down, and just, I would sleep sometimes 4 hours a night, and other nights I'd sleep for 16 hours, you know, without even turning over. It was just very chaotic, and it was just exhausting. So I didn't have a lot of energy to go to a lot of meetings. So I thought, because I was very tired, I said, you know, if I went to a couple of meetings a month, you know, I think it would work. See?
Go to lots of meetings.
Then he said, and we don't drink in between meetings. Which had never occurred to me. I tried not drinking a day at a time. That's true, I did. And I can't do a day at a time. Now, the reason I cannot do a day, and this is just me, if you can, I'm thrilled. But I figured day at a time out when I was around 11. And I know they say a day at a time, but they mean forever. So I can't do a day at a time. When he's, in fact, if Gary had said, we don't drink a day at a time, I just would have walked out the door. It would have just been awful. So when he said, we don't drink in between meetings, what occurred to me was if I went to a meeting tonight, and in Berkeley they started at 8:30 and were over at 10, and as far as we were concerned, that's the way God liked them. If I went to a meeting tonight at 8:30, which was over at 10, all I had to do was not drink until the 8:30 meeting the next night, which was not 24 hours, it was 22 and a half. And for some reason, that made all the difference in the world. It's kind of the difference in advertising between ferociously expensive and affordable. You know? Where you can't think of one, but the other one might have hurt, but over years, maybe we could do it if we don't eat. That kind of difference. And so I'll go to a meeting a day. You know, this may be easier. And then he said, we go to lots of meetings. We don't drink in between meetings. And then he said, and we don't use no dope. If I knew that, I wouldn't have come. I had been smoking non-habit-forming marijuana every day for 7 years. Especially when I wasn't drinking. But I was so defeated and so broken and so discouraged with my own life by the time I got here, I figured if those are the rules, those are the rules. And I was so stupid when I got here, I did not know you could leave if you didn't like the rules. I figured if you show up at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 29, you do what they say. And he told me real practical things to say. And it was very clear. So that was my program for over a year. I went to an awful lot of meetings. I did not drink in between meetings, and I did not use no dope. And I just held on to that as my moral absolutes. A lot of other things would come, but those were clear. And then I went to meetings, and I took, like I say, dope and booze, and most of my favorite kinds of dope were depressants, because I like staring at walls, feeling deep, and all that. Well, when the depressant starts wearing off, things that have been depressed for years start waking up. And the depression for me started wearing off somewhere around 3 months of sobriety. And the first feelings that began waking up for me with a vengeance were not feelings of peace and equality. They were feelings of rage and fear and generic hostility. And I just didn't know what to do with these because I'm from a nice family, you know, and we never had those feelings. And all of a sudden, they were there all the time. And I felt very uncomfortable and very nuts and very wild. And I just kept going to meetings, but I knew I had to do other things. So one of my problems with my emotions was I couldn't match the emotions with words. I didn't know. I mean, I'm a college graduate. I know how to spell fear. I don't know what it feels like inside of me. I know what anger is all about. I can see it in you. I didn't know what anger... I couldn't be angry. I was funny. But all of my rage came out in humor. You know? And a lot of people got real nervous when I got going. I always thought it was a gift. Very uncomfortable. And so, when I was about 3 months sober, I went into therapy. And the book says we can. You don't believe me, I know, but on page 133, it says, God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such persons. Therefore, going to see a therapist is part of the program, if you need one. And I sure needed one, and I went to a very wise man in Berkeley who had a lot of experience with people who were drunks and junkies. And I started seeing him twice a week for 9 months. And we started connecting words and feelings. It was very, very helpful for me. But those early months were real uncomfortable, and I can remember thinking that all I really should have to do is stop drinking and my life would be fine. And I stopped drinking and my life became real. And it got very unpleasant. So I would see Leonard a lot. And on one occasion I went into him and I was real, real nuts and real confused. And I didn't know which end was up. And I said, Leonard, do you think I'm normal? And he looked at me and said, normal is 98.6. Well, I've accepted that definition for a long time, but I would now add to it another definition. Normal also is whatever goes on in your neighborhood. I've traveled a lot recently, and I find things that we consider real normal in Oakland, they haven't even heard of in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Don't even know. The big shock for us in Berkeley was in November of 1984. Every 4 years, our higher power lets us make choices, as you know, for high office. And in November of 84, my neighborhood, Oakland, Berkeley, went 84% Mondale Ferraro. 84%. We read the papers the next morning and found out that the rest of the United States, from sea to shining sea, disagreed. We went into shock. We didn't know anybody who voted for them. How'd they win? You know, well, it wasn't normal for our neighborhood, you know. That's all it meant. And you start finding out if, you know, you feel real out of place in your neighborhood, move. You know, there a lot of other places are happy to see you. Normal is a very relative term. So I said, Leonard, what am I trying to ask you? And he said, what you're trying to ask is, are you healthy? I didn't know that's what I was trying to ask, because I've never thought of myself as healthy. I've always thought of myself as being a variety of kinds. I always catastrophize. I mean, I get toothaches and know it's brain tumors, all kinds of stuff like that. I've never thought of, healthy. So I said, what does healthy look like? And he said, you can spot healthy people in a crowd, because healthy people are capable of doing three kinds of things. Number one, healthy people are capable of working. Number two, healthy people are capable of loving. And number three, healthy people are capable of playing. That's what healthy people do. And I said, go on. And he said, Tom, what your alcoholism did was it destroyed your ability to work. You couldn't leave your room. And I said, I could too. And he said, I'm talking about 2 days in a row. Picky. As far as loving goes, he says, to love somebody, you have to trust. He says, is there anyone in the planet you trust? And I said, sure, lots of people. He said, name one. George. When was the last time you saw George? 10 years ago? Easy to trust. And when it came to play, I had no idea what he was talking about, because in my background, play was not encouraged. See? I'm from a family that works, and the virtue is working. And take it, good people work. Better people work harder, you know? And so what I've always done when I have felt awful and disgusting and loathsome is I've worked. That's how I've handled guilt, and that's how I've handled inadequacy. I will just work. And I kind of used work as a way of staying very, very busy but get nothing done. I'll do that a lot, which it doesn't. That's not what grown-ups do. So I said, how do you find out how to play? And he said, you can't read a book on it. You have to go do it. And I said, give me a suggestion. He said, well, some people recreation is something that recreates me. It's something that recreates my soul. And Leonard said, Tom, if you do not learn how to play, you will never get well. I said, give me a suggestion. He said, well, have you ever been to the beach? And I said, sure, lots of times. He said, sober? I said, no.
Because when I was at Bellarmine here as a kid, we would go over to Santa Cruz and Aptos and drink Red Mountain wine and chase girls and throw up. We thought that was very sophisticated. And occasionally we would go to Santa Cruz and drink Red Mountain wine and throw up and then chase girls, and it never was as effective. And we thought that's because they were unsophisticated. Oh, my. So Leonard suggested that I try going back to the beach straight. And a couple of us did this in Berkeley. We had never been to a beach straight in our lives. We went to a beach in Alameda. We fully dressed. We stood there for about 15 minutes, hating it, not knowing what to do next, and left, saying, we'll never do that again. And Leonard pointed out that when we start to learn new things, we have to try these half a dozen times before we even know if we like it, because it's new and therefore wrong. You know, and a lot. I'm someone. I don't want to learn anything. I want to be graceful at the start. That attitude can keep me in my room and stupid for years. And one of the signs of getting well for me was when I decided it was okay to be clumsy, and it was okay to make mistakes, and it was okay to ask, how do you do this? Because I just didn't know. Leonard was very, very useful for me. And I found that whenever I'm talking about my recovery or when I'm talking about someone's sobriety, it has to be real pragmatic for me, and therefore, how am I doing for sobriety's sake? I have to take a look at, am I working? Am I capable of working? Am I capable of loving? Am I capable of playing? If that's happening, I know I'm being restored to sanity. Because sanity means health. I get mixed up on sanity. I think sanity means thinking real clear. Some of the craziest thoughts I've ever had are crystal clear. Or I think that sanity is being logical. And I have met some people who have been locked up for years who are so logical they can't function. You see? Sanity is a much bigger thing. It's being psychologically and emotionally healthy so that we can work, love, and play. This is what earth people do. You see? And I find as my ongoing program of recovery is paying attention to those areas in my life. I also found out that when I was 5 years sober, a job that I had done for years, I could no longer do. I was a teacher. I trained as a teacher. And I found out that it was no longer fun. It was no longer free. It was no longer challenging. It was just awful. And I think a lot of us find out that what we can do loaded, we can't do sober. And we start experiencing that awful thing of job change. Real scary. So that's always good for a topic at a meeting. How do we change jobs? When I first started meetings in Berkeley, one of the chapters we would read on a regular basis was the first part of chapter 11. And I'd like to just spend a few moments tonight because I think it's a real important part. We'd say at the start of the meeting, for most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. Now, I'm real glad that in our literature that description is there. Because it clearly points out that we do not think drinking is a moral issue. Lots of people can do it and have a wonderful time, and our hats are off to them. If we could do it and still have a wonderful time, we'd still be doing it. We didn't come here because we were having such a wonderful time. You know? I had too much joyous intimacy. So I came to AA. You know? Oh, too much companionship and colorful imagination, so I thought I'd recover. Just not our story, you know. We're thrilled for them and we're thrilled for us. Then says, but not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. That, in, 50 words or less, summarizes my drinking career. Nicely done. Then the next paragraph. And this is where the writer of this paragraph took out his Roget's thesaurus and started using exciting words. He said, the less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol. Graphic phrase. Shivering denizens of his mad realm. The chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. Now, what I read, that may have been read 100 times while I was in the room before I first heard it. But the first time I heard that, I sat up straight in my chair. Because all of a sudden, someone was talking to me. I mean, the 12 steps are fine, but they're theory. I'm living today. The chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. Yeah. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Now, I'm very grateful that that line is in here, because I thought I was the only person in the world that did that. And I found out that even in a book written by Midwestern old people in 1939, that kind of thing was going on. Momentarily we did, then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. And I understood. This is the first page that hit home. And I just suddenly went, connect. Maybe I can get well. Then it says, now and then a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time. That kind of brought me up short, too, because at periods of time when I wasn't drinking, those were the exact words I'd use. You see, friends would say, Tom, how are you doing? It's been a week since you had a drink. And I'd say, I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time. Amazing. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take half a dozen drinks. Notice, not one. Half a dozen drinks and get away with them. Now that's one of my best phrases. See, I knew that if I'd been drinking, I had gotten away with it if I could get back to my own room. But then I got into a phase where, to make my life better, I changed the furniture in my room. And I had a bed, a desk, a chair, and a lamp. Not a lot of furniture, but I'd move this over there. And then I'd go out and have a couple of social drinks and come back, forgetting where everything was. I have cracked ribs getting into my own room. And people used to think I would drink in rough bars. No, I had a furniture that attacked me. He will presently try the old game again, for he is unhappy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. And then the next sentence that I think is one of the most powerful and healing sentences in all of our literature. It says, "We have shown how we got out from under." And that's what we do. We don't nag and preach and scream and shout about what you are supposed to do with your life. What we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is we share how we got out from under. And I think that's one reason why so many of us are able to get well. Most of us don't take orders real well. But when people clearly just, this is what we did to get out, I can start taking some of those things, like going to lots of meetings and not drinking in between meetings and not using no dope. Now, when I'd been around for a little while, I knew I had to get a sponsor. Why? Because everyone said so. It was just awful. And sponsorship is such a strange phenomenon. Who do you get to be your sponsor? And of course, we look in a sponsor for someone who is like a combination of Jesus Christ and the Renaissance man. I mean, somebody wise and learned and, deep wisdom and understanding and all that kind of stuff. That's why most of us don't get sponsors for so long. But I was told that if you don't get a sponsor, you'll drink again. I mean, that there wasn't even a perhaps in that. Or you might drink again. They said, you'll drink again. So I looked around the room, and I found a guy named James. And James was a couple years younger than me and had a lot of tattoos. He told me that whenever he drank, he broke out in tattoos. So the reason I asked James to be my sponsor was because I could be with him and not throw up, which is pretty good. He didn't make me want to just barf. He was a good guy, and he told the truth when he spoke. And he was also 3 months more sober than I was, which I thought was a miracle. Now, his sponsor was a longshoreman who was 3 months more sober than him. So any information that we passed down was new information. And there was something very alive about that. I'd just be going into something, James would just be coming out of it, And therefore, I had hope that I could get out of this, because he did, So it was very important. Anyway, what do you do once you have a sponsor? Well, at meetings, what I heard was when you're having a really awful day, crisis, you call your sponsor, and you say, crisis! So, at around 3 and 4 and 5 months, when I was feeling so awful inside, I would call James and say, crisis! And he would say, what step are you working? Last summer, we went out for lunch, and he now lives in Chico and has a family, and he's still sober and alive. And we kind of relived some of those days, and he told me that the reason when I called in crisis, he would say, what step are you working on, is because when he called his sponsor in crisis, his sponsor would say, what step are you working on? So it was kind of passed on wisdom. And I didn't know what step I was working on. I was in pain. So I'd have to make something up. Oh, I'm working on amends, I didn't even know what amends were, this program stuff. Oh, 12 step, I guess. Program. So what I started, where does that go with James? That was important for some reason, but I got confused. I think what a sponsor is for me, I don't need a guru, thank you. You see? And I don't need another parent, thank you. I spent years getting over the ones I had. to make some decisions on my own. And when I first got sober, I didn't know if I liked chocolate or vanilla, you know. And I find over time, last time I had a major job change, I was trying to explain this to my sponsor, and I said, I could do A, B, or C, or I could do red, white, or blue. What should I do? And he said, Tom, they're both good choices. Yeah, but what should I do? See, because if he told me, well, do this one now, you're only 9 years sober, if he told, then I could blame him if it went wrong. See? Instead, I get to make my own decision. So rabbit's foot and midwife, I think, are real important to me. And I moved to Los Angeles, and I needed a sponsor down there. So I wrote the Cardinal Archbishop, and I said, is there a priest anywhere in the Archdiocese who's sober? That's what I basically said in the letter. I said I was going to be ordained the next year, and I would like to connect. Well, I got a letter back saying, call Terry R. So I got to L.A. on a Friday, and I went to 5 meetings and called Terry R. on Monday, and I said, hello, Terry, my name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm over at this school, and I'm going to be ordained a priest this year, and I really need a sponsor. Will you be my sponsor? Now, I did not know what he looked like. I did not know who he voted for. I did not know what he thought about the fourth step. I didn't know any of those crucial issues. What I needed was a sponsor. And his question to me was, how many meetings have you been? He said, how long have you been here? I said, Friday. He said, how many meetings have you been? I said, 5. He said, yes. And he's been my sponsor for over 8 years. And I had to check him out because how do you know you can trust a sponsor? Well, you drop little hints and innuendos around and see how they respond for a while. So every Monday night for a year, we went to this awful meeting in downtown L.A. It was called the White Flag Men's Stag. Oh, dreary, dreary, dreary. And we would all sit in a circle and smoke Marlboro box and drink black coffee, so you knew it was real AA. And then he had this popsicle stick with a white handkerchief tacked on it in the middle of the room. And people would say, what's that for? And he'd say, surrender. So we'd go to that meeting every Monday night, and at this time, it was time for me to be dealing with steps 4 and 5. All right. Well, I did a fourth step. And I find out I did it pretty much the way the book suggests, which is a big surprise to me. I started with a whole list of people I wanted to see slowly dead. And then I made another whole list of things I was afraid of. And then I wrote about sexual stuff. And then I wrote about finances. And I find out that's what the book says. That is a fourth step. And I wrote whenever I was in great pain, and as soon as the pain passed, I stopped writing. So it took me about 18 months to do a fourth step, from 6 months sobriety to about 2 years sobriety. And when I was done, I only had about 10 or 12 pages of stuff, you know. But because I would write for 2 hours and then not write for 3 months and then write for a couple hours. But if people could say, are you doing your fourth step? I could say, you betcha. And I had to do this. It says, admit to God, yourself, and another human being. Well, I thought I'd use Terry. And so we made a date and we sat down and he was sitting over there and I read, you don't have to read, but I read all this stuff. The reason I read all this stuff is because I was so nervous. I just didn't want to look at him. For 2 reasons. Number one is a lot of this stuff was really boring and it was my best shot and I didn't want to look up and see him, you know, going, or checking his watch, you know. So I didn't look at him for that reason. And I also didn't look at him because some of the stuff I thought was real sleazy and real embarrassing, and I didn't want to look up and see judgment on his face. So I admitted to God, myself, and the floor the exact nature of my wrongs. You know? And another human being was in the room. Got to the end of it, and I guess it took half an hour. And my experience with a lot of fifth steps is a lot of fifth steps take between 20 minutes and an hour. And I finished and I was done. And the book, to my understanding, says, we admitted, it does not say, and then we discussed. See, I was done. And I wanted him gone. And he fooled with his beard and then cleared his throat and said, well, one thing's real clear. Now, I don't associate with people for whom one thing is real clear. I don't like them and I don't trust them. And I was just waiting for him to summarize this fourth step. And your problem, Tom, is... I'm just going, oi, you know. He said, what's real clear, Tom, is that both you and I need this program very much. And he got up and left my room, and I was thrilled to see him go. Now, I didn't talk to him for 6 more months. You know? Why? Well, for 2 reasons. Number one is I wanted them to give him some time to forget. But the second thing was I was kind of afraid that I'd call him the next morning and say, Perry, let's go out for coffee. And he'd say, you know, I'm real busy this year. Who needs that? So I just didn't call. Now, he didn't call because he's an introvert. And as you know, introverts always wait for you to make the first move. So he was just waiting for me to call and being blissful, living his own little Al-Anon life. And we finally met at a church function, and neither one of us ever goes to church functions. So it was, you know, coincidence. And he was there, and I saw him across the room, and he did not look disgusted to see me. So I walked up to him and said hello, and we reconnected. And we have spent a lot. He's still my sponsor after now, 9 years he's been my sponsor. And we know each other very well. In fact, I just saw him yesterday. What's the point of that? The point of that is I was 2.5 years clean and sober before it occurred to me that I had one person on this earth that I could trust. And I think real things take time. And I think slow is real. And I'm also of the opinion that the first 5 years of sobriety are real early years of sobriety. And a lot of us were so upset because we're 6 months sober and aren't making $100,000 a year yet. You know? Slow is real, and these things take a lot of time. Now, when I was 7 years sober, all of a sudden my life changed. I mean, I moved back to the Bay Area. Moved back to Oakland, where I'm living now. And all of a sudden, I had a very difficult job situation, and family stuff started coming up again. And what I began feeling at 7 years sober was a lot of grief and a lot of sorrow, and I didn't understand this at all. I mean, I hadn't experienced grief and sorrow before. I worked through the rage and a lot, but this was I would just feel so sad, and I didn't have a word for this. And I started also feeling, at 7 years clean and sober, clumsy. And I started feeling very awkward. And I started feeling that my timing was off. And when people talked and everyone laughed, I laughed like a minute later, you know? Now, I drank over feelings like that. I did not drink over the big things. I drank because I felt stupid and clumsy and thick. And rather than feel stupid and clumsy and thick, I'll use. But here I was at 7, and I felt so fragile. I thought I'd start crying, and so I went back into therapy, and I found out that I needed a sponsor closer to home. Terry was in L.A., and that was 500 miles away. I needed someone I could see regularly. And I found a man in Berkeley whose name was Julian, and Julian is, he's about 5 or 6 years sober, so I have more time. But he helps me tremendously. And when I see Julian, I feel safe. And I would just go up to him and say, Julian, it's really awful today, and these are the feelings that are going on. And I find both with Julian and with Terry, what they do real well is they listen, they do not panic, and they stay out of God's way. And I think that's very, very wise. I'm very lucky to have two people like that in the program. And part of that's because both of them do a good Al-Anon program. And I think that's a... For me, that's been a real healthy part of my own recovery. I went into Al-Anon when I was 2 years or 3 years clean and sober. I was a teacher, and I was teaching in L.A., and every year we'd bury a kid who would end up against a tree with a belly full of beer at 90 miles an hour. And I was teaching, one little sparkly kid, his name was Peter, he was started the year just funny and laughed at all my jokes, so I knew he was bright, you know. And he was really a joy to be with. He was 15 years old, and then he discovered dope and other things, and changed, went through all the personality change, shut down. Just shut down. And so by like January, February, he wasn't feeling anything. He was sitting back, you know, and he was just completely cut off. And one day as he was going into my class, I grabbed him. And I just started, I was so angry at this kid. And I screamed in this awful voice. I said, Peter, you walk like a junkie. You talk like a junkie. You stink like a junkie. And I threw him down in the chair and started class. Now, if you were 15 years old and had a drinking problem, would you come and see me? I was acting like a crazy person, just enraged. And so I knew I was in trouble, and I didn't know what to do about this. And I was doing a workshop. I was doing a retreat for a mixed AA Al-Anon group in Riverside, which is just this side of the moon. And it was New Year's Eve, or right around there, and there was a man who was an Al-Anon, and he talked about how to live with a crazy person and not go crazy. And it was the first time I'd heard a male Al-Anon. And his wife was an alcoholic. And I suddenly occurred, as a New Year's resolution, I said, I'm going to start going, I need this. Yes, I'm clean and sober, but I don't know how to live with other people without manipulating or controlling or being a martyr and a victim and all that kind of stuff. I need to learn how to do that. And I found that an awful lot of my serenity and joy comes from very practically learning how to love other people, and that's what Al-Anon talks about a lot. So if you've been sober for about 5 years and are on speaking terms with no one, you might want to take that as a sign from your higher power to try another 12-step program. I do believe that. So here we are today, not loaded. And I find what I, you know, what's my program? What my program is, I have started incorporating the 12 steps in my own life. I find that, and a lot of the 12 steps, what I'm condensing them right now to, I've seen a lot of women and men get well, and if I do what they do, I'll be well, I'll get well too. And I see women and men do this. They show up. Number one, they show up. There's a temptation, it's an awful temptation I get. It's a temptation to disease and destruction, and the temptation is for me, when in trouble, to go to my room and figure it out by myself one more time. When I'm alone in the room with my mind, I'm in bad company. So what I need to do to get well is show up. Like show up where? Like to meetings. Like to my jobs. Like to my relationships. Like to my obligations, like to my own skin, my own feelings. An awful lot of recovery for me has been me just learning who's home, you know, and therefore learning how to get out of his way, you know, instead of short-circuiting doing all kinds. So showing up is a crucial part of getting well. What's another part? Paying attention. I've shown up a lot of places and I haven't been there. I know I was there because I saw the pictures, but I was gone. So when I'm there, I've got to pay attention to what to me and my feelings and my thoughts and all the stuff churning inside of me, and I've got to pay attention to you. What you're saying and thinking, and I have to take you seriously and honestly and lovingly. So showing up, paying attention, and the third thing that women and men do who get well is they tell the truth. To whom? But start with my, I have to start by telling the truth to myself. And then to a couple other people. And then maybe to the whole world. And that process enables me to walk through some awful times. A woman in the East Bay, her name is Bobette, and she says, when you get sober, you feel better. You feel everything better. And some of us come in figuring that now that I'm not drinking or using, I should feel sensational all the time. And that's just not true. But what you do get to do is you get to feel all the time. And what I find sober is there are good days and bad days. And during the good days, what I try to do is show up, pay attention, and tell the truth. And in the bad days, what I get to do is show up, pay attention, and tell the truth. Instead of saying, oh, I'm 7 years sober, I can't be feeling this. What will the people say who I sponsor? Well, the people I sponsor, those lucky individuals, are real clear that I am one drink away from a drunk. I tell them, always be surprised when I show up sober. And I credit this as a sure sign of the fact the program works. I am a man who, at almost 10 years clean and sober, is in desperate need of God's grace. I'm in desperate need of the fellowship. And I'm desperate need, not of not drinking 24 hours at a time. I don't drink in between meals. I'm not drinking till breakfast tomorrow. And then at breakfast, I don't drink till lunch. And at lunch, I don't drink till dinner. Because it is still too overwhelming for me to not have a drink all day. I can't even imagine going for 24 hours without a drink. It's just not possible. But here and now, it's fine. What a speaker is supposed to do at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is share experience and strength and hope. And my experience, strength, and hope is very simply this. If you go to lots of meetings, if you don't drink in between meetings, and if you don't use no dope, and instead of drinking and using dope, you show up, you pay attention, and tell the truth. One day at a time, we become women and men who are capable of working and loving and playing. Thank you.